On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, big contests all over. Colts versus Bears at the Super Bowl, man versus the environment on global warming, the White House versus much of Congress over the way ahead in Iraq.
While I do not in any way question your honor, your patriotism, or your service to our country, I do question some of the decisions and judgments you've made over the past 2.5 years.
What I was attempting to be, but not very artfully, is complimentary. This is an incredible guy.
They searched for suspects, ordering these men to the ground as they tried to separate militants from pilgrims making their way to the holy Shiite city for a major Muslim religious festival.
Ladies and gentlemen, the state of our economy is strong.
Barbaro has pulled up on the first turn. The rider is off.
This device looked like a bomb.
There is an old saying in Tennessee, he knows it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, you can't get fooled again.
Senator John McCain grills General George Casey over his handling of Iraq. Joe Biden trips at the starting gate. Holy days and more death in Iraq. President Bush talks up the economy on Wall Street. Well wishes aren't enough for Derby winner Barbaro. A bomb scare in Boston, and Texas firebrand Molly Ivins loses her long battle with breast cancer. This hour on Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. We're headed way out of the Washington bubble this week for perspective. Joining us today from Miami is Tom Fiedler, executive editor of the Miami Herald. He's former editor of the paper's opinion page and longtime political reporter. He covered Joe Biden's first presidential run in 1988. Tom Fiedler, thanks a lot for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
And with us from Iowa City, Iowa, James Lynch, political reporter for the Cedar Rapids paper, The Gazette. He's been watching the world and a lot of 08 presidential contenders from his perch there in the heartland. James Lynch, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, James, and Tom.
So here we are, a lot on our plates and tornadoes in Florida. Tom Fiedler, first of all, are you okay down there?
Oh, yes. That tornado line went right through central Florida, just a little above and northeast of Orlando, but hasn't quite reached us yet. Hopefully the tornadoes will have spun out of it by then.
You've got Super Bowl fever, no doubt, in Miami. At the same time, people watching the debate, everybody's watching in Washington over Iraq. What's your sense of how the people in your readership are now looking at this white-hot debate on Capitol Hill, Tom?
Well, you mentioned that Super Bowl. I think it's perhaps hard to find news of the rest of the world around here, given the—
It's all
the
Colts and Bears.
Right. Our own kind of tornado here that's been going on for a few days and won't pass for a few more. But you mentioned the debates on Capitol Hill and Iraq. I think that clearly is the subtext of virtually all any discussion that you would get in with somebody about national policy, and the mood here wouldn't be that much different, I think, from Iowa City or New Hampshire in terms of the concern about where we are going and whether this the new strategy, the so-called surge, is the right way to go. It whatever space is left in my newspaper from Super Bowl coverage, a great deal of it is eaten up by that still.
James Lynch, how about you there in Iowa City? A lot of blurring of party lines right now as the debate heats up in Washington. What about Iowans? How are they looking across party lines or by any other sort of way of cutting the cake here? What perspectives are you seeing emerging here as Republicans themselves on Capitol Hill get into some pretty tough talk with the administration?
I think if Iowans aren't opposed to the war and the surge, they're certainly looking at it as the last chance to do something positive in Iraq. And I would say for Republicans, it's especially troubling because the specter is that if things don't turn positive in the next 3 to 6 months, they're basically faced with adopting Democratic positions of withdrawal, phasing down the troop levels, or essentially cutting and running. It's very troubling, but a real sense that this is the last chance.
Let's listen to a bit more of that exchange between Senator John McCain and General George Casey. He's nominated to be head of the whole army. He's been the top commander in Iraq. In this exchange, McCain, the Arizona Republican, asks the general whether he pursued the right strategy in Iraq.
General Casey, I was interested in your opening statement, which continues to be optimistic. In recent days, the Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Abizaid's designated successor, Admiral Fallon, have all stated we're not winning and we had a failed strategy. Now, those are clear-cut statements for the record. Do you agree with that?
Do I agree that we have a failed strategy?
We had a failed policy and we are not winning.
Senator, I do not agree that we have a failed policy. I believe the president's new strategy will enhance the policy that we have.
So you view this change in strategy as just as an enhancement of the previous policy?
Well, it's a significant shift, but I believe it will be an enhancement over the current policy. But I don't... The policy of training and equipping Iraqi security forces and gradually passing security responsibility to them as they are ready is still an important element of the current strategy, and
so,
it's part of the Amman Agreement.
So you disagree with the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Admiral Fallon that we had a failed policy?
I do, Senator. I do not believe that the current policy has failed.
Parsing failure and shreds of hope there in Washington. Jack Beatty in New Hampshire, what do you make of the conversation, the debate that's emerged this week in the Senate?
It's an important debate, but, you know, this is going to be a symbolic resolution. There'll be, even if it passes, and it's not clear whether it can get by the 60-vote threshold to end the filibuster, even if it passes, it will not have any effect on whether this goes forward or not. And that's troubling because an even larger problem looms immediately over the horizon, and that is the administration's continuing ratcheting up of tension with Iran. They were going this week to come out with what they called a, quote, mountain of evidence that Iran is arming the Shiites in Iraq, but they put off that announcement this week amid what reports say are disputes in the intelligence community about the quality of the evidence. Well, of course, that means people in the CIA are telling Cheney's shop, we don't have enough evidence to go along with this. And Cheney's shop is telling them now just what they said in 2002 about Iraq. Never mind that. Put whatever you've got out there. Recently, the Los Angeles Times sent a reporter out along the border region talking to American soldiers in that area about the Iranian involvement. And the basic picture was, well, here and there we find an Iranian cartridge or shell casing from 1980 or something, but we don't find any large sign of this. And yet the administration this week announced that the Air Force is going to have a more aggressive flying policy over the borderlands. In short, we're right up against what looks like a repeat of the lead-in to the war with Iraq, this time with Iran, a nation of 68 million people with compulsory military service starting at 16 years of age, and which used soldiers as young as 9 years old in its war against Iraq.
Tom Fiedler, how does it look from Miami? Do you see the prospect of another potential war marching up behind Iraq here, right next door with Iran?
Well, given the picture that Jack has painted, I think it's certainly something that Americans need to be thinking a lot about and expressing their views over or concerns over. By the way, I think an irony here in the administration's efforts to demonstrate Iranian involvement in Iraq. And we have a story from our Baghdad bureau in the Miami Herald this morning, which makes the point that a lot of the army of Sadr is equipped by weaponry that has been essentially stolen from the U.S. military. or the U.S. military had provided to Iraqi forces, which very quickly was shifted hands and went over into Sadr city and is wound up in the hands now of that particular militia.
So never mind Iran, look homeward.
Never mind Iran. That's absolutely right. It's the old Pogo line about we have met the enemy and the enemy is us.
James Lynch, you've had a lot of presidential contenders coming through Iowa, of course. What's the tenor of their comments here? Do they want to get into it? Are they trying to look away from it?
It comes up. I mean, they're asked about Iran, and obviously I don't think anybody wants to see us go to war in Iran, and certainly not the folks in Iowa. I think there is a fear that we're approaching Iran in a similar way that we approached Iraq, and that scares a lot of people here, and they want the 08 candidates to stand foursquare against any military involvement in Iran.
Looking at Iraq, already looking at Iran as well, and the candidates, are they putting this front and center? Do they feel they have to?
I wouldn't say they're putting it front and center at this point, no. There's still much more talk about Iraq than Iran and then other issues, but it's certainly a topic that they're being asked about as they come through Iowa and visit with folks here.
We're looking at a week in the news, from Iraq battles on Capitol Hill to global warming, Joe Biden, Super Bowl fever. We're joined from Miami, where the big game will be this weekend, by Tom Fiedler. He's executive editor at the Miami Herald. James Lynch is with us from the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Jack Beatty's here. A big report out just today from Paris on global warming. Here's one of the climate policy experts watching this, Bridget Woodman, saying that this is the strongest evidence yet of man's culpability.
A large portion of the doubt behind the science has finally been removed. And I think most people would now unequivocally accept that man is causing these sort of climatic changes that we're seeing.
And a U.S. government scientist with the panel, Susan Solomon, at the Paris News Conference, saying signs of global warming are everywhere.
Changes in Arctic temperatures and Arctic sea ice extent, changes in precipitation amounts, ocean salinity, wind patterns, and some aspects of extreme weather, including droughts, heavy precipitation, heat waves, and the intensity of tropical cyclones.
James Lynch, the weather and climate matters everywhere. It certainly matters in the breadbasket of the country, and you're right in the middle of it. How are Iowans looking at this? First of all, climate changes. Does it enhance or threaten the sort of the growing power of Iowa's fields? And what about the ethanol piece of this? The president's pointing there big time. Do Iowans imagine themselves as the new Saudi corn princes?
Well, I don't know if they would compare themselves to the Saudi oil princes, but there is a lot of excitement about Iowa's role in energy, being able to grow energy in our fields, whether using corn for ethanol or other biofuels. There's also a lot of wind energy in Iowa, and there's a lot of talk about Iowa becoming a net energy exporter, becoming self-reliant or independent, energy independent. Whether that's actually possible remains to be seen. But it's certainly creating a lot of excitement and a lot of opportunity for farmers and other folks who want to get involved in creating biofuels.
Is there talk about what climate change might do to the agricultural strength of Iowa? Do people assume that it's invulnerable, or could it be, you know, is it going to become even more productive or less, or does anyone have any idea?
Well, there's been some discussion about that. I would say more at the academic level than, you know, down at the local grain elevator level. There's talk about, you know, longer growing seasons. Do you grow two crops a year? Yesterday I was in a state legislative hearing where a natural resources official was talking about growing three crops on a field in 1 year, growing corn for either feed or energy, and growing cool grasses for energy production at the same time. So there is some impact there, but I think that's more like I said, at the academic level.
And Tom, how about in your neck of the woods? They're talking here about potentially a couple of feet ocean rise in the next century. Miami's right there at ocean level.
Yeah, we could start buying a beachfront property in Orlando or something when if this. It'll be a while, so you better look at this as a long-term investment. You know, it's interesting, though, to talk about the biofuels because, of course, corn is what people think about, and Iowa certainly put that stamped that into the brains of anybody who runs for president. But down here, we have sugarcane. And if you look to the biofuels programs in Brazil, which have been very successful, that is that's basically dominated by the sugarcane. And so that industry, which isn't insignificant in Florida, is looking at the possibility for a resurgence in that area as sugar prices themselves teeter. People on diets or people switch to the sugar substitutes, they may be thinking more like these Saudi oil princes that you mentioned here.
put that sugarcane fiber to work as energy.
That's right.
Not on the waistline necessarily. James, what about farm subsidies? That's in the news this week. The Bush administration proposing ending farm subsidies for what they call wealthy individuals who are farming. How's that being received in your neck of the woods?
Well, I think there's support for that. There's also a sense that nobody really wants to give up a subsidy until they know for sure they don't need it. You know, if your uncle is giving you a check every month, you don't want to say, hey, I don't need it anymore. So there's concern about a safety net for farmers. But certainly the farm economy is changing because of the new markets created by ethanol and other fuels. Tom raised a good point about sugarcane, and I think there's a growing sense in Iowa that corn into ethanol, while that's a good process right now, it's probably not going to last forever because there's been research done on using sugarcane, switchgrass, poplar trees, or cellulosic materials that might be more efficient in producing these biofuels. So corn into ethanol or corn into fuel may be a relatively short-term experience for Iowa farmers, and they're looking at, you know, what's the next generation? How do we sustain this renewable energy economy?
James, we want to get a sense of this flow of potential candidates and declared presidential candidates coming through Iowa lately. Hillary Clinton there this week, and at the end of her visit at a town meeting, she was asked if she could stand up to tough men, evil men, as the questioner put it.
What in my background equips me to deal with evil and bad men?
The crowd responds. Later on, she clarified that she was just trying a little levity.
You guys keep telling me, lighten up, be funny. You know, I get a little funny, and now I'm being psychoanalyzed.
James, here's in the polls anyway, the front runner on the Democratic side. How did Iowa receive Senator Clinton?
Very well. She created a lot of excitement, a lot of energy. There's still buzz about her visit to Cedar Rapids last Saturday night. Talking to some folks yesterday about just the throng of reporters and cameramen and audio folks who were trailing her around at this house party, that it was created a few tense situations for people. The real people, the Iowans there, I guess you might say, who were Hillary Clinton wanted to talk to, felt like they were being pushed aside. I think her response there about what experience does she have to deal with evil men shows one thing, and that is that she can tell a joke better than Joe Biden or John Kerry. And, you know, people talk about her being cold. Well, you know, she's funnier.
Jack Beatty, you were watching some of that town meeting via the miracle of television. What'd you see?
Yes, I watched the town meeting at Des Moines High School, and you know, I've been critical of her campaign style based on my watching her in 2000 running for the Senate, where she really basically ran a listening campaign. She didn't talk. She wouldn't answer questions. And then of course her public speeches have been wooden, notably the one at Martin Luther at Mrs. King's funeral. And in a few other occasions in public speaking, she hasn't distinguished herself. But here in Des Moines, she was in her element, and she was pithy. She was funny. She was using her star power without abusing it, without making it a celebrity moment. She was connecting with the audience, and notably, she was connecting with women there. A woman raised her hand. She was a social worker, and she said, "You know, people in my profession aren't paid as much as we should, partly because this has always been a woman's profession. And a nurse yelled out, yeah, and nurses too. And a teacher yelled out, yes, and elementary teachers too. And this woman said, you know, this is a cultural matter. People need to change their attitudes, don't they, about this? And Hillary said, you know, you're right. Women are slighted in that way. That's a lag. We need to appreciate the work that's done by women and not simply exploit them. That's the kind of question, you know, that affects millions of people every day, never gets asked at with a male candidate. She answered it and brought out that kind of question. And suddenly it occurred to many people that the idea that being a woman running for president was a negative may have to be somewhat changed, that there could well be a positive effect precisely from women who are able to talk about issues that are real to them without being condescended to by a male candidate, or without being given simply blather by someone who doesn't know what he's talking about.
We see poll results here from the Des Moines Register saying 2/3 of the state's adults believe the country is ready for an African-American president. A smaller majority, just 55%, say ready for a woman. Let's take a call from Manchester, Connecticut, and Tony. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Good day, gentlemen. How are you all?
Very well. What do you see, Tony?
Well, I'm glad you've got some guests from the primary states, because my general comment would be that it seems to me that the states are falling over themselves to have the biggest and the earliest primary, and the election season is dragging out. It's getting earlier and dragging out longer and longer. But yet we still don't seem to have, as at the end of this result, we still don't seem to have anybody worthy. I was watching a television special on, I guess, the grand opening of the George Washington Museum down in Mount Vernon. And
right.
I'm thinking, we no longer have anybody close to that stature. Even when people in Congress talk about, you know, the elder statesman so-and-so, these people aren't even close.
You're setting the bar high, but you're longing, Tony, and we hear it. Tom Fiedler, what about it? Florida is one of these big states looking to move its presidential consideration up earlier and earlier. What's on the wheels there?
There is legislation that could be heard as early as next week here that would move the Florida primary up until the last Tuesday in January, which would be, I guess, as it's currently set up, one week after New Hampshire. And you know, it's this lust by states, I think, to say, hey, I'm important. Come look at me. Come see me. I think that that you know, one thing I would is it Tony the caller?
Yes.
I would say that the pressure is to move these primaries and caucuses up earlier in the calendar, but it doesn't drag them out. It has the opposite effect. It tends to get it over more quickly.
It's big states like Florida and California, the giants decided, huh?
And that's right. And then it's over. I mean, even in 2004, the primary process wasn't that protracted before Kerry emerged on the Democratic side as the winner. I mean, I think back to the 1984 presidential primary, where you had that was the year of Walter Mondale and Gary Hart and John Glenn and a whole bunch of others. And that primary started, obviously, with Iowa first, and then you moved to New Hampshire. And it wasn't settled until California and New Jersey voted the first Tuesday in June. So that was a six-month-long kind of battle. And so the question really is, what is better for voters? Well, the parties would tell you that a very quick processes and settle it early on is best, because then everybody can recover and the party gets back together and you can raise a lot more money than the protracted ones. But I think the electorate loses out on that, because you just don't have the opportunity to really get a sense of who's who. And you shut out, I mean, the former Iowa governor, Tom Vilsack, he's really dead meat in this process.
Why?
I tend to think.
Why? Because it's slam, bam, and done before he can mount the kind of public awareness that it would take for him?
Not only that, but anything he does in Iowa is discounted by the national media as well. It was, you know, it was a hometown stand, so of course he's expected to do well. So, you know, the game is not who wins or loses. It's who does better than expected. And poor Governor Vilsack is there. He's expected to win in Iowa, or at least do very well there. And, you know, when you start sending in Hillary and Barack Obama, you know, the poor guy, he'll be lucky to finish third in his own state, and at that point he's dead.
Well, we'll see. But if you line up Florida and California right behind that with the money it takes to run there, it does become A tall cliff. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from Bridgehampton, New York. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
I'm here cleaning out my horse barn, and what I'm interested in is certainly global warming. We're a coastal community, and we could be flooded just like the Gulf Coast. But I'm very concerned and interested in the talks going on in Congress and the Senate about the minimum wage. I could really care less about the Super Bowl or the Libby trial.
Are you getting paid the minimum wage for cleaning out the horse barn there, Sarah?
No, I work for slave labor. These are mine. I know a lot of people trying to make a living, both here and down on the Gulf Coast, and I'm sure around America, and they can't, frankly, on minimum wage. In our area, there is no way you can feed yourself, house yourself, and clothe yourself and work for minimum wage. It's really sad.
Let's look at it. Jack, I think that's all passed this week, right? The Senate has passed it as well now.
Well, they passed it, but they passed it. They didn't pass a clean bill. In the House, it was a clean bill, just an increase in the minimum wage that doesn't, something that doesn't cost the taxpayer a dime, that doesn't add to the deficit. In the Senate, the Republicans would not go along with that. They insisted on, I think, about $8 billion in tax cuts for small businesses to offset the minimum wage increase. That is to say, the deficit will be deeper by that much. And there's a question now whether the House will go along with that, whether the House will, in conference, say, no, we want a clean bill, and therefore you won't get a minimum wage increase.
James Lynch, how about it? In Iowa, does it matter? Are people hanging on this? We're told it's a small fraction of Americans who make the minimum wage. How's Iowa see it from your view?
They're not hanging on it because the Iowa legislature just passed a $2.10 raise in the minimum wage.
Like many other states. Yeah.
Right. They wanted to move before before Congress moved on it, so that's been signed into law. It affects a small number of people. One of the criticisms of the increase is that it's too timid, is that, as the caller said, no one can live on minimum wage, that if you really want to make this meaningful, you have to raise it. We saw a study here earlier this winter that it you really need about $11 an hour to be able to live on minimum wage, you know, on an $11 an hour minimum wage. So $7.25 is too little. So I don't think they're hanging on it, but there was pretty much universal support for raising it.
Tom, you've got some high-paid football players coming to town this week, but what about the minimum wage in Miami? Does it make a difference?
It doesn't, not in Miami. There, in fact, there is an ordinance here in the county that calls for the livable wage, which I think is something in the order of $9.50 an hour already. And as in Iowa, the state minimum wage is already above what this federal minimum wage would be. However, what it would do is that some of the neighboring states on the northern border of Florida, well, the only border, I suppose, of Florida, Alabama and Georgia, they don't have minimum wages at the state level. And so to the extent that an increase in the federal minimum wage would help reduce a competitive disadvantage by those businesses up there that are in Florida, I think that there is a very, very small impact on the positive side for us here.
Mm-hmm. Right now, Carrie is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I could comment on lots of the political things being in Iowa. I would like to comment on Molly Ivins.
Mm.
I grew up in Texas, and when Ann Richards died a couple months ago, she was the first governor that I remembered. I thought, well, you know what? At least we still have Molly Ivins, and now we lost her. And I'm just really worried about where the new strong woman voice in the South is going to come from. Those are people that I grew up hearing, and they were, you know, really inspiring as women who knew what was going on and were smart. But there's something about being in the South where you can put things in such a way that, you know, they're a little less offensive, even though you're being a pretty sharp critic.
Lay a little Texas on it, and it's got a down-home feeling, even when the skewer is tough, Carrie.
Yes.
Yeah, that is interesting. Jack Beatty, how about it? Molly Ivins, gone here after a long battle since 98 with breast cancer. She was in, 350 newspapers with her syndicated column. Could be a pretty tough critic, though George Bush had some kind words for her after her death. Carrie says, you know, where's that down-home voice, southern voice, female, that can both deliver tough critique and you know, sound right out of the grain of the country at the same time?
Yeah, you know, she went to Smith College and Columbia University, but it didn't take the Texas out of her. And, you know, in America, liberalism or radicalism or whatever you want to call it, populism, is often thought of as something that's Eastern and Ivy League and egghead and so on. So when you hear a populist, when you hear somebody whose accent and whose approach to things is that of, you know, regular people, demotic, on the street, at talking liberal thoughts, that's what the right really hates, the thought of a Jim Hightower or a Molly Ivins who can talk real and also talk liberal. And Terry Gross yesterday ran some of her hit tunes with Molly Ivins over the years. It was just wonderful. And she told stories that were just hilarious with that timing and that accent. But she also said, you know, I'm a Southern white liberal. And what made Southern white liberals is race. We grew up in a world that was built on lies, and we knew it. And so the lie was, of course, oh, don't drink out of that fountain, dear. It's not clean. But of course, it was for the colored people. But this fountain, you can drink out of that, and never saying why. So we realized that the world, the official world, was based on lies, and we challenged that. And she just came right out of her autobiography, and she said, that made me a liberal, and then the Vietnam War protesting against that made me a liberal.
Her last column said, keep raising hell against the Iraq War this time. Tom Fiedler, you're in a special corner of the South, but what about Carrie's question about Southern voices in the wake of Molly Ivins?
Yeah, it's a good one. We carried Molly Ivins' column here for a number of years, and you know, when Carrie was speaking, I also had to think about Molly's good friend Dan Richards. I mean, those two were cut from the same cloth, and perhaps unfortunately there aren't others around who can take it up. You know, Florida though is somewhat different. We are in the South. Geographically, that's undeniable, but politically and historically, I think we're probably more aligned with the North. There's a saying here in Florida that the further north you go, the further south you get.
And New York sneezes, Miami catches a cold a little bit.
Miami in many ways is New York with palm trees, so that's where our political references often come. And I think that will play out in the presidential primaries as they start to go forward. The candidates that are often running very early here, Hillary clearly has a strong base here and has that she picked up directly from her husband. And on the Republican side, I think Rudy Giuliani has already got a good base here, as will Mitt Romney, who a lot of former Governor Jeb Bush's people have moved over to. So you've got a couple of Northeasterners who I suspect are going to be the people to beat here in Florida.
George W. may be having trouble in the polls, the president, but his brother Jeb has done well in the polls. I've even heard you say there's talk of a Mitt Romney Jeb Bush ticket. If I got that right?
Yeah. Well, a lot of that is right. I don't think that that talk isn't coming from Jeb Bush at this point. He is trying to keep that speculation away, and I think he does want a little bit of distance between having been governor and talk about another race. But it's too tempting to pass up by Republicans, and his connections with Mitt Romney, both personally, friendly. They were Republican governors together, and they have a similar background, born to wealth, prep schools, and so forth. And politically, they're quite similar. They're both ideological conservatives with strong libertarian streaks. And so there is quite a natural fit between the two that it's awfully hard to resist when people start thinking about what that kind of a ticket could do. And if those rumors remain strong, Jeb, by the way, isn't doing anything to discourage them at this point, could be a very big boost for Mitt Romney, assuming he does well in the Iowa-New Hampshire run-up to Florida.
Although, according to Rich Lowry of the National Review, who was on the air the other day, they had a conference of conservatives over the weekend, and Mitt Romney did not impress. That was the general feeling, that there was this feeling that his conversion from being pro-gay rights, pro-abortion rights, on the dime to within the last 4 years to his current more conservative positions, that this was inauthentic and it was coming across as inauthentic.
We've got to touch on Joe Biden's gaffe for just a moment here. At least it sure got received as a gaffe where he talked about Barack Obama being the first sort of mainstream African-American who is articulate and bright and clean and a nice-looking guy. James Lynch, lots of tizzy about that in Washington and beyond. What about in your neck of the woods?
Oh, I think it's being received pretty much the same way here as elsewhere, that people are saying, Joe has stepped in it and may not recover from this. I'm not sure that he has a great deal of support in Iowa as a presidential candidate. He's very well liked. He certainly, warms up to people and they warm up to him when he's here. He's been out here campaigning for congressional candidates in the midterm. But it certainly didn't help him. Maybe he's developing a reputation for talking before he thinks with his remarks earlier about Indians running hotels and that sort of thing. That he needs to watch his mouth, I guess.
Tom Fiedler, one drowned in Super Bowl anticipation where you are, but how about Biden and the way we look at race and politics?
Mm-hmm. I couldn't help but know, Tom, when you were giving the headlines of the week, how you started about Barbero and his tragic euthanization, and then you switched to Joe Biden and you said that he tripped at the starting gate. And I thought, he's going to end up like Barbero in a sense of at least his political campaign at this point. His best hope is to run for Secretary of State.
Ouch, ouch. That hurts, and he's just getting started. Let's get a call from Lowville, New York. Charles, you're on the air. Oh, looks like we've missed Charles. How about Marty in Farley, Iowa? Hi, Marty, are you there?
Yes, hi there, Tom. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
It's a fantastic show, and James, I read your newspaper just about every day there.
Great.
Thanks, Marty.
Just a couple of real quick comments. James mentioned earlier that the question was asked in how are Iowans perceiving this war. All due respects to James there. I don't talk to many people around here that are exactly willing to give George Bush another chance. The tone around here, Dubuque County is where I'm calling from, actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Most people are, they gave him a chance, and once they found out that this whole thing was based on a pack of lies, they want to cut him to shreds with razor blades. There's an awful lot of negativity towards Georgie Porgy up here, and just a couple days ago we got word that a fellow from a beautiful little Mississippi River town, Guttenberg, Iowa, had been killed in the war. And just my comment is I think anybody coming into Iowa with a theory anything less than a pullout of that stupid war in Iraq, they might as well just stay wherever they're at. I just don't think they're going to get very far around here.
Marty, we hear it. James, what do you say?
I think he's right. There's not much support for the war. And even among Republicans, there's a sense that this is the last chance. If it doesn't work, nothing's going to work. And Marty raises a point that if candidates come in here and aren't talking about how we get out of Iraq, it's going to hurt them. Even on the Republican side, John McCain probably has more riding on this surge than the president does, because if it works, it obviously helps him because he can say he was right and we scored some progress. Mm. If it doesn't work, he's dead as a candidate because he can't come into Iowa or anywhere else and with any credibility. So I think Republicans obviously are scared by Iraq because they know that they got whooped in 2006 in the midterms because of Iraq. Mm. And if it's on the table in 2008, they're afraid they're going to lose more seats in Congress, more gubernatorial races, more state legislative races. So at this point, they're looking for a way out. And while they may be hoping that the surge works and shows some progress, I don't know that there's a whole lot of confidence in the surge.
Hillary Clinton in Iowa, of course, this week. Again, we've got a little more tape here. Here she is at a town meeting in Davenport. She's saying, in her view, it's wrong that the president, as she said, is planning to pass the Iraq war to his successor.
I think it's the height of irresponsibility, and I really resent it. This was his decision to go to war. He went with an ill-conceived plan and an incompetently executed strategy, and we should expect him to extricate our country from this before he leaves office.
Saying it straight out, let's take a call from Augusta, Georgia. Warren, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom.
Hello, sir.
Yes, you know, when Hillary and at least when Bill Clinton was running for president, one of the slogans was you get one and you get the other also. And I think the American people are looking forward to bringing Hillary in just because just so we can see that happen again, is that you get Hillary and you get Bill Clinton back in the mix of things.
So you'd be happy to have Bill back in the White House bedroom?
Well, you know, I'd be happy to see Bill Clinton back as president, though, but I know that can't happen, though. But anywhere Bill Clinton can be a part of the government, a asset to the government, I believe people's looking forward to that, because I think what we need is good statesmanship, and Bill Clinton probably will bring all the countries back together, and I think war will be a thing of the past if we can get Bill Clinton back in the presidency, or even close to it, like Secretary of State. Or one of those type
well, Warren, we've got it. Tom Feeler, what about the two-for-one picture when it comes to Hillary and her husband?
Well, you know, that may work with some segments of the Democratic Party, but I think that would just absolutely mobilize the Republican opposition to even greater strength than they already will against Hillary. The idea of bringing Bill and Hillary back together again is, you know, I think that's something that Rush Limbaugh and his friends would just love.
And yet, Jack Beatty, I mean, Bill is her husband, and he makes no bones about the fact of advising the campaign at some level.
Yes, but he's also the baggage, and that's the big downside of her candidacy, it seems to me. All the memories of the Clinton years and her part in them. That's one big downside for the general election. For the primary election, that answer that she just gave in Davenport is the problem. She has yet to come right out and say, my vote helped put these soldiers in Iraq. I repent that. I regret that. That was a mistake. Instead, she resorts to almost Nixonian formulations, passive voice formulations about her responsibility for this mess in Iraq. And instead, she puts it all on Bush. Well, that won't do. She's got to come right out and say why she was wrong. And, of course, the problem there is that some, you know, the Republicans are going to be quick to say, your husband, his own intelligence, or you know, the Clinton administration's own views on Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction are involved here, but she's got that's an incubus for her, this war going into this primary season.
Let me take one more call from Columbia, South Carolina, if I may. Andre, you're on.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, my basic comment here really was, it's not so much that I support the president on the Iraq war.
Mm-hmm.
But I really support the idea of Western countries being able to solve the problem of a terrorist-driven war. You know, with us obviously in Iraq, but as well as the Israelis and the Palestinian war that just recently happened. And even to that extent, even like the Russians when they were taken out of Afghanistan, I think this type of war needs to be figured out how to be fought and how to be won.
You don't want to feel ineffective in the face of all that. James Lynch, what about it?
I think, yeah, there's a sentiment nobody wants to lose. But I think for a great number of Iowans and probably Americans, there's a sense that we already have lost, or at least there's no way to win this war, surge or no surge.
Tom Feeler, we've just got a couple of seconds here. I want to ask. Yes, please.
I was just going to make a quick point that the former U.S. Senator from Florida was Bob Graham, who ran for president in 2004, and his message was, and he stood up on the Senate floor and said that the giving war powers to invade Iraq was going to be a mistake that everyone in the Senate would regret, and that the place to fight terrorism is the place where it started, which was in Afghanistan. And it's interesting how prescient he was, but that was the position, and I think the right one.
Worth noting, we also have to note, with the Super Bowl bearing down on you, you've got Tony Dungy and Chicago's Lovie Smith coming in there, two black head coaches, first time that's ever happened in the Super Bowl. Just another one of these markers about this culture marching on.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful story, both from that standpoint of the two of them. This is historic when you have two African-American coaches lining up against each other. But the other piece of it, which I think is just as interesting, is their coaching styles. These are not the angry kind of Marine boot camp, in-your-face, yell-and-scream, Bill Belichamp kind of people. They see themselves as teachers and leaders, and I think that's very refreshing.
Well, there'll be a lot of eyeballs on that on Sunday. Tom Fiedler, executive editor at the Miami Herald, it's wonderful to have you. I hope you'll join us again. Thanks for being here.
A pleasure. Enjoyed it.
And James Lynch with the Gazette out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. James, thank you very much for your time today. Great to have you.
You're welcome, Tom.
Jack Beatty, great as always to have you. You're going to be watching the Super Bowl, Jack, or on C-SPAN?
I'm a C-SPAN junkie. I'll be watching Iowa Politics.
All right. Well, enjoy it either way. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.